You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Jeff Lynn and Stagecraft, Historic Theaters at Risk, Who Cares? Cillar Black on ITV Reviewed, and the Pretend iPod.
Hello, welcome once again to the podcast from the Rocking Vicar that we call the Parish Council. I'm Magnus Shaw, and he's a living thing. He's Terence Dackham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw. Ockeye, or indeed, Ockney.
Yeah.
The nays have it,
Yeah, so we've sort of gone back to where we started, haven't we?
It was a big palaver. It was all for nothing.
I don't know about all for nothing.
I just said that to be controversial.
But we are sort of where we started now. So
we are really, aren't we? Although with more powers through devolution to the Scottish, Irish and Welsh. And the West Lothian question hangs in the air, or the Mid Lothian question, as Diane Abbott referred to it last night when talking to Andrew Neil. Oh, and then she got really flustered and embarrassed when he put her right.
Oh, dear. Yes. Yeah, well, we shall see how much now changes now that Westminster has got its head. I wonder how quick they'll be to follow through with all those promises they so rashly made. Yeah.
But here's another thing, Shaw. In fact, the very thing. You, Magnus Shaw, accompanied by the excellent Mrs. the Magnus Shaw, went to Hyde Park last Sunday, which in itself is, you know, that's something of sensational in itself. But whilst there, you attended an event starring Jeff Lynne's ELO. I'm telling you things you already know. Now, I know that you intend to write about this momentous day for The Rocking Vicar. Mm. But I did want to ask you about one aspect of Jeff Lynne's performance that I picked up on as I was watching it on television, on the red button.
Yeah.
And at first it was quite touching, as he said, "Oh, I can't believe this," and, "Well, this is amazing."
That sounds like Lennon, not Lynne.
That did sound, that wasn't really a Birmingham or Middlesex accent, was it? But when it became clear that that was all he was going to say, it began to feel a bit repetitive. Now, I'm not asking musicians to become knock-em-for-six comedians, but our biggest pop stars seem to have lost the art of stagecraft. How did it strike you in the arena?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I don't think in this particular instance it didn't really matter. I mean, as you'll read in my piece, the entire day was had an event horizon. It had a central point to it, and that was everybody was there, including Jeff Lynne himself, to play or listen to great ELO songs, and everything else was frippery. And I don't think people wanted funny anecdotes from Jeff about him and Roy Wood trying to squeeze into a mini or anything. People wanted to hear Jeff Lynne play ELO songs, and that's exactly what happened. So in this instance, it really didn't matter. Nothing further was required, and he didn't do it. Those sorts of very short little comments in some kind of tortured artist way or faux modesty. That was him. So they were sort of genuine reactions. I think everybody was glad for him to churn out another hit, not churn out, but fire off another hit. But I think as a general point, I do know what you mean. Yeah.
Well, you see, I wasn't there, so that's fair enough, because you pick up on the atmosphere in the arena. But I just think Barry Manilow at the Palladium, Johnny Rotten at the 100 Club, or even Derek Plate and the Dishwashers at the local pub.
Yes.
You're still a performer. You're in showbiz, whether you like it or not.
Oh, yeah.
And just prepare a few words. Maybe tell us how you wrote the next song, or make a joke about how long it is since you played this next one. Anything.
Yeah.
Just engage with the people who've come to see a show.
Yeah.
I mean, You know, I was just going to say, the Beatles learned this when they went to Hamburg, and they had to change from just standing about. When they were at the Cavern, they used to just stand about smoking cigarettes and even eating sandwiches on stage. And famously, Bruno Koschmider, the promoter in Hamburg, would tell them to, Max Scholl!
Yes, that is absolutely true. And I'm not sure where it faded away, because certainly when you went to see bands in the 80s, there was a lot of that. And if you saw more than one show on a tour, you realised that these off-the-cuff witticisms and anecdotes were actually the same every night. So, there was some preparation there. Perhaps people had more to say in the 80s. I don't know.
Maybe so, but I think that's a very sort of telling point about, you know, the same thing every night, because that's where the whole stage presence business comes from, the old maxim of put on a show. I mentioned before, I know my first job was at that management agency near Marble Arch in Paddington, where we still had acts from the music hall era of the past, the post-war period, coming in and mixing with like the Doobie Brothers and Joe Strummer and such. And we had this bloke, who were obviously all in the twilight of their careers, but we had this bloke whose entire act, his whole career was based on one gag. He would appear from one side of the stage, like pulling a rope, and then he'd walk across the stage, disappear at the other side of the stage yes. with the rope following him, and then after a sort of minute or so, he'd appear on the other end of the rope, having dashed around backstage, you know, when the stagehand obviously took over the pulley. It went down a storm. And, you know, that was his entire act, you know, and he didn't change it. And funnily enough, he didn't speak to the audience at all. So it's a fantastic act. It lasted about 5 minutes overall. And he did that, you know, for I don't know, 40, 50 years appearing everywhere.
But that's quite amazing, isn't it? That A, he didn't get fed up with it and think, you know, I need to, perhaps I'll invent something else. He was quite content to having invented that, which, you know, he probably did, you know, one New Year's Eve at a party and thought, perhaps there's something in this. And I'll do it. I'll start going around doing it as well. That he managed to stay exclusive with his rope pulling.
That's rope. I don't know if I've ever told you about this other bloke. I actually found him on YouTube once, and regrettably I didn't save it. I've never been able to find him again. There was a YouTube clip of him in black and white, of course, doing his act from, I don't know, probably the 1940s. He came on stage, this fellow, and he started singing. And it wasn't a very great voice, and for 30 seconds, like, nothing would happen, and the audience would begin to get a bit restless. And then you begin to notice something wasn't quite right, and a few giggles started. And he was wearing gloves, and he was gesturing with his arms as part of this song, like, you know, you need hands. And slowly but surely, his arms got longer and longer. And he, you know, obviously had these extendable wooden arms under his jacket, and his jacket just getting longer and longer. And by the time he reached the end of the song, his arms reached out, you know, to the wings, and, you know, he remained straight faced throughout, like, you know, sort of, what are you all laughing at? What's going on? And the audience would be in hysterics.
Okay,
you know,
it's a gag. I can see Vic Reeves doing that to this day. I think.
But, you know, I could do that. That's sort of stagecraft, isn't it? Yeah. I know you must have had these sort of venues around Nottingham and Chesterfield.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that doesn't exist anymore, isn't it? And which is, what would you call it? The supper club, I suppose. Oh, actually, they were called nightclubs. Then the word nightclub got stolen and applied to what used to be called discos. But discos and nightclubs, for a very short period of time, coexisted, and they were very different things. Discos were what we know them to be, you know, somebody playing records at a dance floor and some lights. A nightclub was where you went in your absolutely best togs and sat at a table with a candle or a lamp on it, had dinner, you know, chicken or steak or something that would be regarded as, you know, very sophisticated.
Yeah, something special.
Yeah, very special. It's a real treat. And watch performers on the stage as you dined and as the lady, you know, sipped an orange juice, and the man, well, it depends how posh it was, you know, would have a brandy maybe, or even a beer. And that was a nightclub, and the phrase actually got purloined and replaced disco, I suppose, as those supper clubs died away. But yeah, we had two really, really well-known ones in Nottingham, where I grew up. There was one called the Commodore International.
Oh, that sounds grand,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. The Commodore International was a very strange affair because it was just on the edge of a residential estate. It wasn't in the centre of town at all. It was just on the main road out of Nottingham, heading towards the motorway. And when the motorway was built, maybe the A1 at the time. And and just on across the road from a residential estate. But it booked the most phenomenal artists. They had, I believe, Bing Crosby played there. Morecambe and Wise played there. Really, really big talent played there. In this, it looked very much from the outside like an old-fashioned cinema, really. With a big canopy out the front, with Commodore International on it. And they'd have these interchangeable letters, like in the old cinemas, so they could show who was playing.
Yeah.
So although I was but a kid, I would see these names as I went past in my mum's car, you know. And they were extraordinarily big names that played there. Then in town, there was another one on Talbot Street, which was called... the Heart of the Midlands, I believe.
Right.
I had it in mind the Talk of the Town, but that was in London, wasn't it? This was the Heart of the Midlands. And that was the same thing. It was a supper club. The acts weren't quite as big in that one, funnily enough. It was the out-of-town one that had the massive stars play there. But that would get people like Frankie Vaughan. Remember Frankie Vaughan? Mm. Dickie Valentine and Norman Vaughan and people like that. And that became Nottingham Rock City.
Oh, good grief. Yeah, now very much on the circuit, the touring artists.
For many years, now a rock venue, and still going strong, I believe. So we had two of those, and I guess every city did. And it would be something you'd save up for. I would have thought it was a pre-Christmas. You might take her indoors out to have a steak and watch these variety hours.
And a glass of wine for the little
lady. Yeah, and then a brandy for the gentleman, you know, put on the once a year suit, and.
I you know, if that was still going on now, I'd go.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Oh man, I would love to see the modern day equivalent of that. You know, I hardly want to go out for anything these days, but you know that would pull me out.
Yeah.
I'd love to go and see that.
I was young to ever go to these places, but I was very aware of their existence. Still happens in America. Still big in America. The supper cabaret.
I think we have one down here. I think it's at Frimley Green, where they show the darts once a year. And I, off the top of my head, can't remember what it's called. It may even be called Frimley Green. I can't remember. But I saw Bob Monkhouse there, again, 25 years ago.
Yep.
And it was magnificent. It was exactly this. It was, you know, you sat at a table with a tablecloth and a candle and... at your dinner, and then as you sort of relax back in your chair, on would come Bob Monkhouse for a couple of hours of, you know, rib-tickling laughter.
Yeah, yeah. I think in Derbyshire, where I live now, there was one called the Aquarius. Mm. And I've only been here, 11 years, but people who've lived here all their lives have told me tales of the Aquarius, and the Aquarius had the Four Tops and Smokey Robinson.
Oh, my
God.
Amazing. Well, I don't know. I'm sure people would... surely people could tear themselves away from their PlayStations and their iPhones to go out and go to one of these evenings. I'd love it. I would absolutely.
It would be marvellous. Yeah. And it was amazing the names they booked. And there's a great documentary about one further north, one of these supper clubs further north, Batley Varieties.
Oh, yes, that's famous, isn't it?
It is, because they booked all the old blues men from Mississippi.
Wow.
And so, although one would never imagine it, Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, and all these guys came over from Mississippi and played in Batley in North Yorkshire.
And they all knew how to Mac show.
Oh,
this was the thing.
Of course they did, yeah.
And I imagine, you know, the other abiding memory I've got when booking these artists out, you know, one phone I'd have, you know, the a member of the Doobie Brothers saying they got lost in Gloucestershire on their way into London, and on the other line I'd have Frank Strong asking if he'd got any gigs. It was like, Frank Strong, you can never go wrong with a smile and a song, and I always remember him, and he was, you know, really from the post-war music hall variety circuit. And that's what he used to put on his posters. You can never go wrong with a smile and a song, which we could all learn a little from that, Magnus. But what I remember is that all these variety acts, that, especially the singers, they had a sort of trick or two up their sleeve because they'd be contracted for time. The promoters in these clubs would be really rigid with the timekeeping, and they'd maybe do, say, 2 times 40-minute slots. And if for any reason, you know, they'd run a bit fast, or the pianist had played songs a bit too quickly,
yeah,
or something, and they were found with like a minute left at the end, they you know, would get money docked from their pay because they hadn't done the full 40
minutes.
So I remember Frank Strong used to walk around with a little suitcase, and he had little sort of standby gags that he could pull out there if he was running short. And I particularly remember one. He would open this suitcase and he'd pull out a plank of wood, and he'd walk around the stage for, you know, sort of 30 seconds, filling in time, looking confused. And then he said, with his plank of wood, yeah, I'm going to a board meeting. You know, and that would be it. You know, that was his standby gag to fill in a minute, you know, so that he'd get paid for the full 40 minutes.
And of course, for people who couldn't go to the highfalutin supper clubs, there was another enormous circuit, which was the working man's clubs. It was a huge circuit.
Mainly up north, I think, wasn't it?
That's where all the heavy industry was. There'd be miners' welfares and engineers' institutes and so on and so forth. And they were big bookings. If you could get on that circuit, you were made, because, of course, there was one in every town, certainly in the Midlands and the North. And the social secretaries there were, well, as portrayed in Phoenix Nights, actually, you know, they were demonic.
Yes.
You know, you had to go and audition to get on the circuit, and if you weren't up to snuff, they would cut you dead. You know, there'd be no second chance. But if you could get on the circuit, you know, there's a lot of very, very well-known comics and performers who would never have got on TV had they not spent the first 5, 6, 7 years on that working men's club circuit. It was a real route into showbiz.
Oh, I'd love to be in the midst of all that now. I'll have to save some of my other stories of the old music hall acts for another day, including Hilda and her performing Poodles.
Great.
Which, oh my goodness me, that was an act and a half.
I'm keen to know whether she split the fee with the Poodles. Most unfair, if not.
I suspect she didn't. Yeah. I suspect their cut was, you know, a few tins of chum. Oh, that's a story and a half. I must remember to tell that one day. Myself and a roadie from Ducks Deluxe going to see Hilda and her performing Poodles at that that home for the displaced of theatre folk in Twickenham.
All the magicians would be called something like El Turk and Gladys, wouldn't they?
Oh, yes.
Is that a really exotic name for the comedian and a really prosaic name for the assistant? There's a load
of
those.
Of course... What's his name? Daniels and Debbie McGee.
Yeah, yes.
They were the last of that kind of.
They were, and then there was David Nixon, of course. But the ones who never quite made it all seemed to adopt a really exotic name for himself.
Yes,
but his assistant would always be Janet.
Yeah,
so,
the great Soprendo and Elsie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the great Soprendo, of course, was Victoria Wood's husband.
He was indeed. It was just
That was always that juxtaposition of names, wasn't it?
Yes. So anyway, in my view, Jeff Lynne could learn from Frank Strong. You can never go wrong with a smile and a song.
Well, that's exactly what he gave us, and I don't think he needed. Yeah. I don't think he needed to have any patter on that particular occasion.
many of the old music halls and variety theatres are no longer with us, of course. Cinema and then television played a significant role in their diminishing powers to pull people in. But what of the buildings, our old theatres throughout the land? This week, the Theatres Trust announced that 33 of our, as they call it, historic theatres are at risk due to decay, closure or irreversible change. And these include the Brighton Hippodrome, currently derelict and due to be converted into a cinema and a restaurant, a complex, at a cost of £35 million. Mm, yes. Now, what would you do, Magnusshire? Would you spend the £35 million on propping up these old theatres or spend it on modern air-conditioned cinemas and restaurants?
Well, I suppose you can do both. It depends what state of repair the building's in, doesn't it? The old cinemas, in every town and every suburb you go to, you can see a building. You think that looks a bit like a cinema. And, of course, they all were. But only in the centre of towns have they remained cinemas. And indeed, what mostly has happened is they've become something else. And the cinemas are now out of town in purpose-built, you know, whatever you call them, retail parks. We're going to say theme parks, yeah, but you know what I mean? Plazas.
With a Frankie and Benny's,
yeah, exactly that,
next door.
Exactly that one. But you see these great buildings, and there's a carpet warehouse inside them, or a Netto. In Sheffield, there's a Netto inside one of them. Yes, you kind of think, I wish there was still a cinema in there, because they're such wonderful buildings. But yeah, if they're just sitting there and they're full of pigeon droppings and they can't get a fire certificate, I don't know what option you've got. But it does seem a shame to abandon them. What I'd probably like to see happen is for them to become medium-sized music venues, which we really lack in this country now. If you see a band that you like is touring penny to a pound, you're going to have to watch them in a flipping arena. And those arenas are just awful places for the band, for the audience. The whole experience is dreadful in those arenas. You know, tonight Manic Street Preachers, tomorrow night ice hockey. I hate that. I just hate that, because there's no chance of history or atmosphere seeping into the walls like there is in a dedicated music venue. And you know as well as I do, in the 70s and 80s, there were loads of dedicated music venues. They were either former discos, or they were bars with a big back room, or, you know, something akin to that, or former cabaret clubs indeed. But they had bands night after night after night, and somehow when you went into those places, you could feel the atmosphere that this place had, you know, been the heart of some great music for a long time. You never get that in an arena. So I know. And I'm glad they've done it. The O2 academies have started to find venues to do that in, proper music clubs with live acts four or five times a week. But they're the only ones. And I think, I don't have to be any money in it, but medium-sized music venues in old theatres and cinemas would be welcome in my book.
We mentioned atmosphere, and the list includes two theatres in Blackpool, North Pier Theatre and the Winter Gardens Pavilion, which is, you know...
Yes, I was there. I was there earlier this year.
That was for the. I was wondering if that. I thought that's where you went for the Pet Shop Boys, wasn't
it? That's right, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, many of these venues found something of a new lease of life as bingo halls, but with that pastime now having moved pretty much online, even that avenue isn't open to them. But I'm going to disagree with you in the broadest sense, because, and I know I've written about this, you know, extensively, is that, let's say, London theatres, of which I know quite a lot, they were built in Victorian times when people were smaller in both height and indeed weight, and comfort wasn't the overriding motivation. Now we're asked to pay close to £100 to sit in tiny seats with our knees crushed against the seat in front, with terrible sight lines and our neighbour's elbow in our ribs, and indeed in some London theatres with bits of ceiling falling down on you as you watch the play. You know, I say no thanks, knock them down and build a structure suitable for 2014, not 1914.
Yes. That's quite brutal. I do know what you mean. I don't think it's really the building's fault. I would, you know, point the finger at the really useful company or Cameron Mackintosh theatres and say, how come you haven't done this? How come, with the enormous wealth generated from the West End, as you say, £100 a ticket, sort of guaranteed influx of tourists all through the year, how come none of that money has found its way into refurbishing the buildings? You're absolutely right. The last time I went to a London theatre, it was like stepping back to 1968, including the warm gin and tonic at the interval for £5.60.
Exactly.
I would want to. I would quite like to know where the theatrical entrepreneurs have fallen down there and failed to inject money into their venues. So, but it would seem a shame to sort of punish the theatre by pulling it down, because they do have that incredible history, you know, from Henry Irving onwards to right up to sort of Judi Dench, Christopher Eccleston, anybody else you care to mention have sort of trod the boards there, have added their talent to the place. I'm not a sentimental guy, but it would seem a shame for them to just come down because somebody had failed to put the investment in.
Well, from the bigger world of theatre to the small screen in our living rooms, because we've pondered the future of the London Live Channel on this podcast a couple of times when it launched, and a few months ago we reviewed its 7 o'clock in the evening offering, Not the One Show. And the clue to the ethos of this channel is in its title, of course, London Live. Before its launch, it pledged 5.5 hours of news a day and an hour of original current affairs programming, all on a budget of £15 million a year. However, after some rather, let's say, awkward zero ratings for some of its shows, London Live applied to Ofcom for a significant decrease in local programming. In other words, less London and less live. Ofcom has refused this change. So do you see any hope at all of a prosperous future for London Live?
No, no, it's a dead man walking, isn't it?
It really is.
I would cut my losses now, but I don't think anybody was predicting great things for local television. It was a pet project of one Jeremy Hunt, who's since moved on from that job, and I think everybody questioned it at the time. Jeremy Hunt had no background in broadcast media, and but this is the luxury you get as a minister of pushing through your white elephant project. And London Live will come off well within 12 months, and that would be giving it quite some rope there, to say 12 months. I don't think we can take an enormous amount of credit for saying we told you so when this first came on air, because everybody was saying it. So I don't think we had any particular privileged information, just because as a concept it was never going to work, and it hasn't done. Tried to change its formats. Well, that's just trying to cut its losses, isn't it, really? The only time I've seen it is when we were asked to see it for this podcast. But I'm led to believe that what you tend to get is like 10 episodes of Trigger Happy TV back to back of an evening. That's a lot of its content is that, isn't it?
Trigger Happy TV and The Peep Show, I believe, are its mainstays.
Which is great, but I've got DVDs of both of those shows, so it doesn't really establish a broadcast brand showing that, does it?
Tim Kirkman, the chief operating officer for London Live, said this week, "I'm disappointed by this outcome, as I believe the changes would have allowed us to produce an even better product for Londoners," which is really hard to agree with, because, I mean, surely it would have just meant even more reruns of Dom Jolly. And
he doesn't believe that, but he can hardly go public saying, yes, actually, I'm in charge of a doomed project.
This, you mentioned Jeremy Hunt. I mean, his dream of super local television, I mean, appears even less likely now, as you say, than when he was pushing the idea before the 2010 election. He kept saying that they have 8 local television stations in Birmingham, Alabama, and we don't even have one in Birmingham, England. And I think London Live has now shown exactly, you know, why that has never been a major issue for the people living in Birmingham or London or anywhere.
No, I heard Boyd Hilton, the TV critic, talking about this, and he actually, I think, put his finger right on the button when he said, this is because in America, the distances between the cities is vast. And when television first emerged in America, there was no point in telling somebody in Seattle what was happening in Oklahoma. So TV was automatically localized when TV emerged in America. And that established a tradition of local broadcasting. Now there's much more point in telling somebody in Seattle about Oklahoma, but the tradition has been established. People expect to have a local TV channel. We don't have that tradition here, and therefore nobody is inclined to watch it. And I think that's correct.
Yes, well, not only is London Live looking over its shoulder, but maybe it's time to consider if TV talent shows are beginning to see the great gong of doom in their sights. Last year, for a substantial fee, ITV bought the Rising Star format from an Israeli TV company. However, after the show flopped in America and Germany, ITV have decided to cut their losses, believed to be about £1 million. So do you think we're not only getting fed up with London Live, but are we also getting fed up with The Voice, Britain's Got Talent, X Factor and the rest?
Yeah, things inevitably have a life cycle, don't they? And we're probably on the downward slope of that. I'm just looking at the viewing figures for X Factor. They're still healthy, but they're nothing like what they once were, because it's the law of diminishing returns, isn't it? You see the X Factor the first time you've ever seen it, it's intriguing, exciting and engaging, and then the 101st time you've seen it, it's less so. This is true of all entertainment. Even a guy whose arms get bigger when he's singing a song. You wouldn't want to see him, you know, a season of him once a year, would you? And I think the same is true of X Factor. It's curious that ITV bought in a format that only succeeded in Israel and not in any of the big TV markets. That was quite a gamble, equally quite a gamble to axe it before it's aired. They've taken a bath on that, and somebody's got some big explaining to do. Somebody's got a big PowerPoint to show to ITV's executives there. I think we will need to find something difference anew. We can't dine out on X Factor and The Voice forever. And
Peter Fincham, the big cheese at ITV, was really bigging up this Rising Star as recently, you know, as the summer and the sort of television festivals and so on. So obviously it was quite a sharp decision, and as you say, a dramatic decision to drop it. The X Factor, you mentioned the viewing figures. I think it's quite interesting because, yes, they've still got, I mean, you know, 8.5 million is nothing to be sneezed at, as they say, and that's 28% of the audience on a Saturday night, which isn't bad in a multi-channel environment.
Sure.
But they lost 1.5 million viewers in this current run from week one to week four.
Yeah.
Which I think is the most interesting.
Yeah, that seems to happen with a lot of shows that come back, or even new shows. I think we have a more judicious audience now, and I think the first episode of anything has a curiosity value. And I think I would have thought most TV channels now have to factor in how many of those curious viewers will decide it's not for them and peel away after the first showing. So I wouldn't have thought that was too disastrous. I would have thought behind closed doors they'd say, well, yeah, from EP 1 to EP 2, we can expect to lose this many. That conversation must be going on.
If anyone's wondering what this Rising Star was all about, just briefly, the format was maybe a bit too similar to The Voice, in that singers they were performing behind a screen, but the innovative bit was that viewers voted through an interactive app while they were actually singing. I agree with the general feeling is that some significant changes will be needed something innovative to, you know, reawaken interest in these formats.
It's a bit lazy to go out into the market and buy a new talent show when you're already screening The X Factor, I think. It may be a brave decision. It also may be a lazy decision. Let's find another strand to take its place. They must be looking now, because they surely anybody knows that, as I say, everything has a life cycle, and perhaps we're on the tail off of this talent show thing. But broadcast is never been trickier. Just to jump back slightly to the local TV story. London Live struggling there. By all accounts, the equivalent in Birmingham, which may be called Birmingham Live, I don't know, but went into administration before it went on air.
Yes.
So there's the story.
Exactly. It doesn't look good. Although a friend of ours, Sarah Pettigrew from Norfolk, was telling both of us the other day about Mustard TV or something, which is the local one for Norfolk, and seems to be doing quite well. So.
Okay, good. I hate to be a naysayer about these things, and I do like to see people having a shot in that particular arena, in the broadcast arena. I find it really interesting, and it's surprising and gratifying when somebody makes a go of it. But it is such a tricky market to kind of station, radio or TV, must expect to just absorb money for its first 5 years. Must you just got to be prepared to pour money in for a good length of time, and hope you eventually get some traction. That's probably the only model that works.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking quite a lot about theatres and clubs and so on from the past, the 1960s. In early 1963, it was a world where an aspiring singer could badger a group on stage to the point where they would shrug and then act as a backing band for that persistent singer as they took the microphone and belted out a version of a hit of the day. And I was thinking, try doing that in 2014 at Hammersmith Apollo and see how far it gets you. Well, in 1963, Swinging Cilla, as she called herself, jumped up on stage in Liverpool with Rory Storm and the Hurricanes, King Size Taylor and the Dominoes, the Big Three, and the Beatles. And soon to change her name to Cilla Black, this singer was to sign, of course, with Brian Epstein and, of course, George Martin at Parlophone. On Monday, ITV screened the first of three episodes of Cilla, a drama based on the life of Cilla Black. Now, was this your world, Magnus Shaw, or did you lose that loving feeling?
It was a bit of a curate's egg for me. The bits that I enjoyed, I really enjoyed, but with some real reservations. I thought Sharon was tremendous. I thought she was a real firecracker, and she didn't look particularly like Cilla. That didn't matter, because this could actually be a fictional story. It doesn't really matter that it's Cilla Black's life story particularly, because it was a dramatic entertainment, so she didn't have to be a duplicate of Cilla at all. And I thought she was absolutely superb. I think she owned the screen, and she's pretty much in every scene and most shots. So I thought that was terrific. And I thought they recreated 60s Liverpool pretty convincingly. I thought the set dressing was terrific, and the art direction was great. That didn't feel like artifice at all. I liked the fact that everybody was smoking. I noticed with a lot of dramas that go back to the 50s and 60s, they get a bit coy about cigarettes. I guess there's some kind of Ofcom ruling about it, but anyway, everybody was smoking as they were in, and so that lent an air of conviction to the whole thing. So that's the plus side, and I thought the music was enjoyable as well. My big bugbear about Cilla is, I suppose, what I call signposting. I think in the script there are some terrible weighty boulders that you could rebuild Stonehenge from in this sort of clunky signposting of the plot to tell the audience, hey, you know, this is that bit that you know about. For instance, when Scylla meets George Harrison in the cafe, and he is not introduced as, oh, this is George, he lives on so-and-so street, or this is George, you know, you might have seen him at the Cavern, which we could have lived with. No, this is George, he's in a band with Pete Best on drums, they're called the Beatles. He might as well have something flashed up above his head that says, George Harrison of the Beatles, the arrow pointing at him. That stuff is really clunky, and really wrecks that authenticity. Every time that happened, I was popped straight back out of Scylla world and into TV land, because people don't talk like that. And these flags that kept popping up were a bit embarrassing, a bit cringy, but most of all, ruined the authenticity.
Well, okay, now I see what you mean. I didn't pick up on it at the time, but I wonder whether, you know, when Scylla says, you know, this is George Harrison, he replaced with Pete Best, who's in the Beatles, is that for people who are perhaps younger than us or considerably older than us who didn't know that George Harrison and Pete Best...
Yeah, that's exactly my point. The scriptwriter's job is to deliver that information in a way that feels natural and real, and instead of just, I better put a line in here flagging that this is George Harrison of the Beatles. You know, there's another point in the Cavern where one of Scylla's friends says to her, oh, did you hear the Beatles have sacked Pete Best and got Ringo in on drums?
You know, I don't know if you're being a bit unfair here, because, you know the history of the Beatles, and, you know, you've read the books, you've seen the movies, you're as much an expert as many, but probably the majority of the audience don't know the story.
No, but then let's see a scene where, you know, perhaps Pete Best is sobbing into his beer and somebody says, what's up with you, la? And he says, you know, those bastards, they've kicked me out. They reckon Ringo's better. I could buy that. That's probably broadly what happened. But these little interchanges I suppose they're MacGuffins, aren't they? You know, scenes placed in there to drive the plot forward. And I found them really, really clunky.
But it's a big story, and Jeff Pope, who wrote it, only had 45 minutes because of the advert.
I know. Well, therein lies the challenge. But I don't think you can get away with saying, yeah, sorry about the clunky bits, I only had 45 minutes. That's not good enough.
I think we can agree it was immaculately played by Sheridan Smith. I just, what a great actor she is. I really do mean this. I said this on Twitter during the week, and somebody thought I was actually, you know, having a bit of a laugh. But I think she is absolutely extraordinary. She always absorbs herself into the part. And, you know, I know some people will say, oh, for heaven's sake. But I really put her on a par with Robert De Niro in terms of that skill, in that she, whatever role she plays, she just lives that part. And it is so believable. I mean, I am biased. I saw Sheridan Smith on stage. You realise what an incredible talent she possesses. You in Legally Blonde. You know, she was just extraordinary. Yeah. Masterful comic timing and great warmth in the character. It was a really big production, this Scylla, wasn't it? I mean, a really large cast and no expense spared on location and sets. And I thought that really added to the authenticity of it, but it did, you know, what we were just talked about the sort of squeezing in information. It made me wonder if this had originally been considered as a full-length movie, because if you were to put the three 45 minute episodes, bring them together, I'm pretty sure that would work.
Yeah, I think it probably would. Yeah. Look, I think you'd have to do some trimming. I thought 3:45 minutes makes for a long, long movie. But I know exactly. And it felt movie standard, certainly. And it's delivered. The first episode has done good figures for ITV. And it's an interesting story. And it describes a Britain which no longer exists, where pop music was a sort of cottage industry that sort of was making itself up as it went along. And of course, you know, pop music now is an enormous commercial concern. Those kind of places have actually vanished. Those huge corporate concerns, you know, the places, the companies that made everything from manila envelopes to shoe leather, they've disappeared, and the entertainment industry has become the enormous gargantuan industry. And in this, of course, it's a fledgling thing. So they're making it up as they go along, and that's really fascinating to see the birth of the pop industry for real. And I like that, but I just had issues with the script.
I'm looking forward to the next two episodes. It's what, the first of three, because you know, Scylla's own career in real life, if you like, I feel sort of stalled in the mid 60s, and I think Scylla believes that was due to a lack of interest from Brian Epstein. He kind of, you know, ran out of interest of her career, and, you know, was focusing on other artists and groups. And, you know, some people would argue that it was poor advice in terms of, I mean, she just killed off her music career to become a safe Saturday early evening television host. And I wonder, you know, I'm really looking forward to see how they deal with that.
Yes, but I don't know how far they're going to take the story.
No, I don't know. I don't know if it just goes up to the sort of mid 60s, or whether it does take us up, yes, through the sort of surprise
yeah years. I think they'd struggle to get that far in the time allowed.
Yeah,
but it is great. I shall watch more of it, but had I been the producer, I may have asked the scriptwriters to just blend those heavy signposts in a bit more naturally. That's
okay. Well, this is Scylla. It's on ITV Mondays at 9 p.m. That was part one of three. The first part is available on the ITV player. It was directed by Paul Whittington and written by Jeff Pope. And now, it's very strange, this Magnus Shaw, because this happened last week. I'm being just at this exact moment. I'm being told that we've been contacted by Evgeny Lebedev of London Live. Jeff Lynn's been on the phone.
Yes.
Scylla Black sent a telex. And Peter Hitchens has been on saying that he wants an independent home counties. So that they've all been on the phone and contacting us and saying that what their main concern is will we have time to fit in the pretend iPod? And I'm really pleased to be able to tell them that is going to happen.
Oh, people will be relieved, I know.
Yeah, it seems to be a concern of his every week, doesn't it? Extraordinary.
Yes. They're nice of him to care, I think.
Yeah, pretend iPod, we pick a piece of music, we say, you know, why we particularly like it, joins this massive playlist on the Rocking Vicar website, which you can listen to if you want to, and it's also on Spotify, and do you know what? It's on Spotify, it's under your name there, and that name is Magnus Shaw. Yeah,
I know.
Within a year or so of Scylla jumping up on the stage at the Cavern Club, and coinciding, as we were just saying, with the rise of pop music as the major interest for the nation's young people, a young man himself, just turned 20 years old, sent off a demo tape to the new pirate radio ship, Radio Caroline, bobbing up and down a few miles offshore in the North Sea. And he got the gig on the radio ship, Radio Caroline, and from March 1964, Tony Blackburn launched himself into the consciousness of British people, largely for the first part of his career, to breakfast listeners, to Radio Caroline, then another pirate radio ship called Radio London, and then BBC Radio 1 from 1967. Now, Tony Blackburn has spent much of his life being vilified by serious broadcasters and disc jockeys for his apparent corniness and cheerful, grinning style. But to me, Tony Blackburn was the very definition of cool, because it was largely through his love and constant playing of Motown and soul music that I became educated in the form or style of music that's really got to my heart more than any other over 50 years. In the mid-1980s, after he left Radio 1, Tony Blackburn joined BBC Radio London and presented a morning show each weekday that was simply required listening. Freed from the constraints of Radio 1's playlisting, Tony Blackburn, he was able to choose his own records to play, and he built a wonderful daily show of both new soul, it was a really hot period for UK and American soul music, as well as classic Motown hits and Northern soul. In fact, any record Tony Blackburn felt passionate about at that time. So let's spin forward 30 years from 1984 to a couple of Sundays ago. I was driving through Little Venice in West London, just along Warwick Avenue, and I flicked over to BBC Radio London. It was a really hot, sunny summer's day in September in London, and there he is, as passionate about soul music and Motown as ever, on BBC Radio London, Sunday lunchtime. We parked the car. I didn't want to get out of the car until we were sort of really pressured for time, until the last minute, because we didn't want to miss the cavalcade of great tracks that Tony Blackburn was playing. And I'm choosing a track that he played last Sunday. And it proves that if it's great, and it just doesn't matter what category you try and throw at popular music, it's just great music. Back in 1974, Bruce Blackman wrote a song all about his life in Greenville, Mississippi, and meeting his wife Peggy, which is one of those really amazing stories. He saw her photo in a newspaper. She was in an athletics team, and he looked up her name. He found her. He asked her out twice. She said no twice. He asked her a third time, and she said yes. And they got married, and they're still married now. After he recorded this song, Bruce Blackman visited imagine doing this today, he visited all 400 radio stations in Mississippi himself to persuade them to play his record. And eventually, his persistence paid off. The record started getting plays and then wider and wider across America and became a major hit. It's also in my top 10 of all time. As played by Tony Blackburn on BBC Radio London last Sunday, recorded early 1975, released April 1976, reaching number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100, 3 minutes 38 seconds, Starbuck, Moonlight Feels Right.
You do realise you didn't name the song till right at the end there, which was good.
That was my plan.
You kept us dangling. Interesting, the story about him finding his wife is exactly the same as Simon and Yasmin Le Bon.
Is that so?
Yeah, Simon Le Bon saw her as a model in a magazine and said to, I don't know actually who it was, but let's say it was Nick Rhodes. He said, I want to marry her. And do you know what? He did.
And do you know what, Magnus Short? That's how David Beckham got together with Victoria.
There you go.
Beckham.
Seems to
he
work,
saw,
doesn't it?
Saw her on the telly in the Spice Girls and thought, that's the gal
there
for me.
There you go. Seems to work, doesn't it? Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Moonlight Feels Right is a real radio record, isn't it? I think
it really is. I love it.
The only time I hear it is when it pops up on the radio. And I wouldn't say it suffers from this, but it really places itself in its time in musical history because of the synth on it is such an analog synth sound, isn't it? The little trill that they use.
Yes, and it also features probably the only one I know, the marimba solo in the middle.
Excellent.
And amazingly, for a band that really didn't go on to have many more hits, whatever, the original members are still together, still performing, and the guy still does the marimba solo in Moonlight Feels Right.
I'm delighted. I can't only imagine what happens as a Starbuck gig, wherever they were playing last night. What happened? How many tracks did they go through before they played Moonlight Feels Right, and how many times did they play it?
I often think this about bands that are said to be one-hit wonders. They did have some other minor success, but nothing of this nature.
No.
And it does make you wonder, doesn't it, that if you're still touring, that you must every night do, say, a 45-minute set, 40 minutes of which are just building up to your last number.
Exactly. I think there's still a version of Paper Lace out there, and I sometimes wonder what goes into the set other than Billy Don't Be a Hero and how much attention people are paying until they get to that. But we don't know. We've not been to see them. All the other stuff might be fantastic.
Was it Paper Lace that did Agadoo-doo-doo?
No, it was Black Lace.
Oh, Black Lace. I see. I get confused between the laces.
Paper Lace, Good Nottingham Lads, but only managed...
Billy one, Don't Be a Hero.
Yeah, one and a half hits. I think the night Chicago died.
Yes.
But other than that, you know, you can't... I don't know if you can build a night out around the night Chicago died and Billy Don't Be a Hero.
Of course, Paper Lace with a band... you've probably forgotten this. I told you this years ago, that I was sort of helping at the London Palladium when the Queen Mother came along in the 1970s to some godforsaken charity night on a Royal Variety thing or something. And I nearly killed her because I came charging down the stairs because I was, you know, we were running late. Yeah. And I ran into the Queen Mother approaching the stairs. Yeah. And we actually ended up clutching each other on the stairs of the London Palladium. Yeah. And today, I suppose, I would have been taken down with a taser.
Yeah, well, yeah, at the very least, yes.
At the very least. But, we just laughed it off. But I suppose it's why I've never really received any greater honours. no, already have.
But were Paper Lace on that night? Is that the connection?
Yes, they were. Yeah, they were in the queue waiting to meet the Queen Mother. Right. And I got sent off to... I was only a youngster. I was sent off to go and get something from a dressing room or something. And I was coming charging back down the stairs. And boom, straight into the fur and ermine bedecked. Yeah. Her Royal Highness... Her Majesty,
I hate it when that happens.
The Queen Mother. Oh, I know. Well, I met her again about 20 years later. She never mentioned it.
Oh, funny so, that. Funny that.
Yeah.
Well, as a push, I usually find something to like in the repertoire of most bands, because there are exceptions. I think Wet would be one, and Genesis would be another. I'm afraid whichever period you'd care to choose of Genesis's career, I just don't get it. The Phil Collins stuff seems just incredibly lightweight and disposable. And the early stuff, and I know there's much affection for the early Genesis years, the Lamplight Down on Broadway and so on and so forth. It all strikes me as horribly indulgent whimsy, fairly tuneless, and not for me at all. Anyway, cue a barrage of emails, because I know there are some aficionados of that period of Genesis. But I know... Really, Genesis have nothing to offer your correspondence here. But interestingly, once Gabriel left his hairy pals behind, he strung straight into my affections. I'm keen on almost all of Gabriel's solo stuff. He needed to be cut loose from Genesis, as far as I'm concerned. And I actually really love his highly commercial 80s material, particularly the album So. That album that people know extremely well. It bagged the Best Album Grammy and the Brit Award for Best Album in 1986, and deservedly so.
Oh.
And it's really a blistering collection, packed with invention and big hit singles to boot. And none was bigger than the unforgettable Sledgehammer. Now, I would think it was... the remarkable video that went with the track, really, that ignited most people's excitement about it. This, of course, was the MTV-dominated 80s, and there was no better way to promote your single than using a stunning clip. And this one broke more ground than a pneumatic drill. I don't need to describe it. You've seen it. I've seen it. Everybody's seen that video so many times. But it doesn't pull. It doesn't even look that old. It's a really groundbreaking piece of work. But... let's not ignore the song itself. That stands on its own 2 feet without the clip. It's brilliantly produced to within an inch of its life, which was the way in the 80s. it rocks you backwards with those stabs and blasts of horns, a tumbling percussion. And it has a really, really gripping grasp and release structure to it. It tenses you up and then lets you go. Over it all, of course, is Gabriel's yelping, idiosyncratic vocal. You can never mistake Peter Gabriel, I don't think. And although it does carry all the traits of those grand 80s hits, its power and talent and originality really carries it through the years. So its appearance is never unwelcome, whether it's on your iPod, on your radio, on your shuffled Spotify. It's always good to hear that again. So it's my pick for the iPod this week. It's Peter Gabriel and that fabulous record, Sledgehammer.
So it'd be hard to explain to a young person today, wouldn't it, about what a sort of delicious shock this was when this video was either on Top of the Pops or, as you say, coolest of all, on MTV, which was actually unbelievably young people. MTV used to show music videos because it was called Music TV.
Yeah,
and this was so innovative that I think people, not that it wasn't a great song, it's tremendous. I think some people probably went out and bought the song on the strength of just loving the video. You know, it had that much impact. I think Peter Gabriel, he's one of those kind of national treasures, isn't he, really? Because I think the only mistake he made was getting out of Genesis too late. You mentioned The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, he left after that. That was the worst evening of my life, was The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, presented by Genesis at Wembley Arena, or Wembley Empire Pool, as it was called back then. It was just concept album gone mad. Mm-hmm. And, he left. And as I say, credibility has stayed with him, whereas you say, you know, the other fellows of Genesis, they may sell a lot of records and they may, still make a few million, but they haven't really got the kudos that Gabriel has got.
I think they would deny this, but I think at some point they became Phil Collins' backup band, didn't they, really?
Yes, that's a fair point. I saw them as a teenager, and I imagine probably Peter Gabriel was still a teenager. They came to Brooklyn's College in Weybridge. They used to put on gigs there quite regularly. They're quite a nice little sort of theatre-y place.
There you go, medium-sized music venue.
Yeah, well, there you are. Yeah. Yes, indeed. And this was before I Know What I Like in Your Wardrobe. It was in the very early days. And the only thing I can remember is Peter Gabriel, even then, had an amazing stage presence. He had the front of his hair all shaved back.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And he was wearing, like, masks.
Yeah, and a big flower. A big flower on it.
I don't remember the flower. You're probably right. I don't remember that. But I remember it being, one really thought of them then as, well, when I saw them live, it was before they really broke through, as kind of avant-garde.
Totally.
You know, it seemed a bit kind of weird.
Could
never have predicted what was to become of them and him later on.
No, absolutely. No, he had a headpiece which was all the petals of a flower with his face in the middle of it.
Now you say that, I can picture it. Come back to me. Yeah. He did indeed. I remember that.
And I would invite anybody, and you included, Mr. Dackham, to pull up a picture of Peter Gabriel as he looks now, and then pull up a picture of David Essex as he looks now.
They do have a certain... Yes, they do, don't they?
Both have neatly trimmed goatee beards.
Goatees, yes.
And a slightly thin on top silver fox thing going upstairs. And
twinkly blue eyes.
Exactly.
Both have twinkly eyes.
Yes,
yes.
That's right. Yes, yeah. They do look rather like brothers these days, although they never did in their heyday. But anyway, there you go.
Very true. Two distinct tracks there, then. Starbuck, Moonlight Feels Right, as heard on the fabulous Tony Blackburn show on BBC Radio London, 94.9. And Peter Gabriel, Sledgehammer.
Yeah, as you rightly say, another pair of plump, melodious plums sitting in the fruit bowl, engraved with the words, The Pretend iPod. Bringing us to a close this week, we must dash, as this week we're meeting a busted blood vessel of bad manners for a sauna and a rub down at the Sweaty Sailor Spa in London's Old Kent Road. So we'll look forward to that. Just time to thank the aromatic Terence Dackham.
Be seeing you.
For his pearls of wisdom, as always, great stuff. We're also, before we dash off, a quick get well soon to our friend Rona, who's a bit under the weather, and we give her a cheery wave. As she recovers in her boudoir. Hats off to you too, our favourite listener, and we invite you to consume more at therockingvicar.com, therockingvicar.com. We will be back soon, but until then, bye-bye. The wind blew
person looking my direction. I caught it in my hands today. I finally made a tricky French connection. You winked and gave me your okay. I'll take you on a trip beside the ocean and drop the top of Chesapeake Bay. Ain't nothing like the sky to dose a potion. The moon will send you on your way. Moonlight feels right. Moonlight feels right. We'll lay back and observe the constellations and watch the moon smiling bright. I'll play the radio on southern stations, cause southern builds a hill at night. You say you came to Baltimore from Ole Miss, a class of 7-4 gold ring. The eastern moon looks ready for a wet kiss to make the tide rise again. Moonlight feels right.
Media production.
When you walk, let your